Hi, Patrick.
Oh, yay.
It's bouncy me again. Because I want to talk about performance oh, and performing, because you've done a lot of that. Click my fingers then. You've done a lot of that.
Hey, I'm catching the ball. You're throwing the ball.
Exactly. Do you remember the first time you performed, though?
Of course I do. Yeah. It's burned into my memory. I was an elf.
I thought it might be.
I was an elf in a school play. And we had to use the toilet just before we went on stage. And there was no toilet paper. And I had to wear someone else's tights. I pulled up the tights. And all hell ensued in the back of those tights. And then I had to prance on stage like the world's happiest elf. Except...
Did you poo yourself?
I pooed the toilet. There was nothing to clear it up with.
Whose tights were they?
I shouldn't say her name on air because it's not fair on her. Her name was Caroline Phipps.
Oh, Caroline Phipps.
Caroline Phipps. White tights. Well, the formerly white tights of Caroline Phipps were handed to me. And it was, it was just a disaster. And I had to prance around the stage and I was trying to extract the tights as far away from my shredded remains of a bum to protect the tights of Caroline Phipps. And I was quite noble and valiant in my efforts to keep her all right and her tights as clean as they could be. And I rushed home with this sodden, disgusting, manky pair of tights. And my mum promised me she'd wash them, not realising what the problem with the tights were as they were wrapped up in a little bag. Got them home, got them back to school. The teacher said, thank you for the tights. She unfurled them in front of everyone and it was a storm. A hellish brew that I concocted the night before flung around the classroom as those tights unfurled.
I'm wishing I hadn't asked.
Yeah, well, I'm wishing I
came in a bouncy mood about performance. I'm wishing I hadn't asked.
Yeah, well,
and the line that will stay with me and with everyone is shredded remains of a bum.
The Match, because 90 minutes can last a lifetime. Atalanta Primavera against Brescia Primavera in Bergamo in 1993.
If you take a quick glance at Richard Hughes's career, you'd see a record of quiet and fairly typical success. A spell in the Arsenal Academy, followed by a professional life that was almost entirely focused on the South Coast. He played for Bournemouth and Portsmouth and then Bournemouth again, developing a relationship with Eddie Howe, which has led to him being a trusted advisor of one of the most talked about talents in the world of English football management. A role in recruitment that means he has to be a good judge of a player, a reader of the game, constantly capable of sizing up any situation. Richard has an FA Cup winner's medal and can look back on a talent fulfilled, with one exception. This lover of Italian football, brought up in Milan and fluent in the language, might have done a deal or two with Serie A clubs, but never actually played for one. He was schooled in the famous academy at Atalanta, the source of so much Italian talent, and the lessons that he learnt there prepared him for his future career both on and off the pitch. And there were more lessons in his debut for the big academy side than in any other game in his career. Because Atalanta played Brescia, whose team contained the future World Cup winner and Hall of Famer Andrea Pirlo. And Richard's story has a twist. He'd be playing at centre-back and not in the centre of midfield, where he'd always played. His big chance to shine, and yet he was thrown off balance. The game was played in Bergamo at Atalanta's youth centre, and this is how Richard was feeling in what passed for a tunnel.
Scared, Dave. That was the overwhelming feeling I remember, because when you're one of the kids coming through the Giovanissimi and then the Allievi and then making your way up, so that would be like the under-14s, then under-15s, you're making your way, so this Holy Grail, the Primavera. And we had as a manager quite an iconic guy, even though he went on to have the career we all thought he would. He was still held in really high regard. It's Cesare Prandelli. And he and his backroom staff were sort of in suits and ties and immaculately presented. So this is youth team football becoming serious here, because before that it had been tracksuit type of managers. And I remember he's got, as people will have no doubt can testify now, he got a very good manner about him, an aura about him. So I was probably in fear of him as much as I was of the whole occasion that lay ahead.
And in fear a little more because of the news he had for you before kickoff, or whenever he told you, but he told you you were playing out of position.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, so I'm at 17 and probably 1 or 2 years younger than most of my teammates. I had a couple that were of the same age, but none of us really expected to play. And I remember when we were going to just check the grass before the game, and it was nice weather, September afternoon, so quite warm in Italy at the time. And Brandelli called me to one side and said, you know, I'm going to start you. So then, you know, butterflies, adrenaline starts kicking in. Oh my God, am I ready? And then you're going to play centre back. And then it's like, so from those normal feelings of fear to, oh no, 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 this is too much. What do you mean I'm playing centre back? Obviously, I didn't say anything of this. I was just like, he tells me I'm playing centre back, I'm playing centre back. And he told me that, you know, you're next to Arnaldo Bonfanti, who I actually, we used to get a bus picked us up from Milan and brought us into Bergamo to train, those of us who lived in Milan. And Arnaldo was one of the older ones who shared the bus. And he goes, you know, Arnaldo's your friend, you'll be fine, he'll talk you through it. And that was a reassuring thing, the fact that I knew who I was playing alongside, and the fact that I knew that, because it's quite daunting. I think the Italians, maybe it was just my experience, but coming through the youth team, they felt the older players, you were scared of them as well. So, because, you know, they could bully you. They, you know, if you got it wrong, you were messing up their day as well. But Arnaldo was the type of guy who was going to just get me through this game, and that's how I saw it.
And there was a legendary figure on the other side that presumably you already knew about. Andrea Pirlo went on to win the World Cup. One of Italy's greats would be playing for Brescia that day. And did word get around the academies of that he existed?
Yes, it did. And because Pirlo was, he was the same age, is the same age as me, so he was playing comfortably above his age, though he had been in the Primavera the year before as a 16-year-old and may even have debuted in the Primavera as a 15-year-old, such was his talent as a kid. But yeah, he was one of those mythical characters that we knew existed at this team that was, what, 30 kilometres down the road. Our local rivals in Brescia, and they had this talent that was going to be one of the best in Italy. This was how it was presented, and there's a bit of envy and a bit of jealousy, and how good is he? And every so often you could, and bear in mind back then with mid-90s, so this you don't really get a lot of coverage of them unless you play against them. And we'd come up against Brescia quite a lot of times, and in my own age group, and you got there and is Pirlo playing? No, he's away with the older age group. So this time there was no escaping him. He was going to be playing for the Primavera. The fact that if I'm playing my natural position back then in midfield, I'd probably have been up against him just as much, because Pirlo actually played in the 10 position, just off the striker. But knowing that I was going to play centre-back, knowing how good he was or supposed to be, because up until this point, you don't know, but you believe what you hear because they can't all be wrong. And they also had another character in 6 foot six plus, Emiliano Bonazzoli, who lovers of Serie A will remember from, or you'll tell me more than I will tell you, Regina Sampdoria. But he was, you needed a stepladder to get up to him. So he was actually my primary concern, because at the time, I'm not sure, I ended up, I'm 6 foot one now. But I was like, how am I going to win balls in the air against him? How am I going to get anywhere near Andrea Pirlo? And how am I generally going to cope at a higher age group playing out of position? This was a nightmare.
Yeah. And so how did it go? I mean, how did it start? How did it develop? You didn't lose the game.
Well,
I think you only conceded one goal, so it can't have been that bad.
No, it definitely wasn't bad. And it's one of those, I always thought when I played football, whenever I was nervous enough about something, that means it meant a lot. And I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy the anticipation. I didn't enjoy necessarily during it, although once you start the game, that all else goes to one side. To an extent, you think, what was I worried about? I'm now playing football, which is what I like to do and want to do. But you only sort of enjoy it afterwards. And I remember... Now, I'm sure we didn't get beat. It was one, because it's 20 years ago, and I was doing my job. I was just like, don't concede. And we hadn't conceded until about 10, 15 minutes to go. And we did, from a free kick, which was taken by Pirlo, a wide free kick, but no, it wasn't one of them. It's not going to end in spectacular fashion with him. No, it wasn't like that. He hit a wide free kick into the box, which we half cleared. A midfielder called Corioni, who was actually the chairman, Brescia, former president's son, he scored for them. So whether that made it 1-0 or 1-1, my memory is a bit vague about that. But either way, after the game, Prandelli was very, very complimentary to me. So were the other teammates. And I felt a big sense of pride, the fact that I had got through such an ordeal. The actual game itself, I remember actually doing well. My dad tells me I played very well. He always did, though, and he was there scouting, which is interesting, actually, because he went on to work soon after that, actually. He was a scout for Everton, and when I ask him afterwards, like, how good was Pierre Lelem? Because I can't remember. I mean, I would have had a strong opinion if someone was very good, but out there he seemed as if he had a really good right foot and an aura about him, and he played in the hole. And my dad said, no, he didn't appear to me the player that then went on to become, well, 10 years later, was winning the World Cup. Was it 10 years later? It would have been, yeah. Won the World Cup with Italy in a different role, of course, in front of the defence. But maybe my dad's just trying to justify the fact he never put him into Everton at the time and did his job miserably. And that's why Pirlo remained in Italy.
Now, you footballers are a cynical bunch, and I think intelligent footballers like yourself, who you don't mind, are possibly a little bit more cynical than your regular footballer. But you talk about Prandelli in a sort of different way to the way you talk about most other people. I'm sure there are some others. Eddie Howe might be one, for example. But he had a huge influence on you, didn't he?
Massive, Dave. And considering I was only there for 1 full year under his management before I came back to play for Arsenal, but one season, whereas an allievo nazionale, which is the year just before it, every so often if you got drafted in to train with the Primavera, you would. So I'd had that year of experiences of working under him. But he was... I attribute him and another manager of my youth team days, Savoldi, as being the two major influences on my career. Everything I learned tactically, I learned from those two, and probably tactically actually just from Prandelli in 1 year, because that was at the age where you were sort of learning the game a little bit more from a tactical point of view. And there was no one better than him at teaching tactics, so much so that actually having the career I had until 35, and the only reason I think I managed to survive later on at the top level was because of my a tactical reading of the game. Physically, I was nothing. I was slower, you know, weaker, nondescript. Technically, I was okay, but there was much better around. So I believe that the only reason I managed to play at the top level was because of an ability to read situations and read the game, which was completely instilled into me. Okay, first and foremost from my father when I was learning the game, but then from the actual playing side of it and professional side of it, Cesare Prandelli, bar none, was the biggest influence.
And can I ask you how he did that? Because I think that would interest people who aren't footballers.
Yeah.
How does he teach you tactically? How does that work when you're a teenager and maybe a short attention span? How does he? Is it just drills? Is it whiteboards? What is it?
On the pitch, first and foremost, that was the main thing. It was the fact that it was on the pitch. He would talk about how he wanted the game played, but I can't really recall those experiences so much. It was actually what we did on the training pitch. You're absolutely right to point out attention span, and the fact I think made him so good, now thinking about it, is because of that aura I said about earlier. The presence he had, he talked, you listened, you knew then if he was very concise, and he didn't use more words than he had to explain what he wanted. But I remember certain things that he used to implement. He used to love playing a 4-4-1-1 system, and he played that the whole time, so he taught that very system. And you had certain rules, for example, set pieces within open play. So, for example, if the wide left midfielder passed the ball infield to the left-sided central midfielder, his only option was a first-time pass round the corner to the number 9, who offered himself for the layoff for the number 10. And he was so... This is just one example, of course, but he was absolutely regimented. This had to be done, to the extent where he would take players off the pitch in games if they didn't do it. And it was very strict and very, you know, almost say, well, where's the creativity? But from that actual move, the fact that everyone on the pitch, our team, knew that that's what was going to happen, the passing sequences that followed it were actually very, very impressive. And because when you do that as players and you think you can see you're getting rewards from it, you fully buy into it. And it was like, we used to love that very thing, left midfielder into central midfielder. And I knew, I can't really get this wrong. My decision's taken out of my hand. I'm just going to flip it around the corner here. Number 9, bounce it at 10. We've got runners off the back of that. So that was an example of him instilling tactics, not just set plays, but set plays from open play, which I think he was probably slightly ahead of his time when he would do that, and why he had such a good reputation. The other thing about the back four, he used to work us with a huge rope. So he used to make people work with a rope. If you were working with your central midfielder, you would have to hold a rope. So if you're looking in the left-hand side, the movement that you would make would actually tug the rope, so you would know your teammate was moving, and things like that, things that were quite innovative at the time, and I haven't done anything like that since. No one got the rope out since I came over to the UK. But just working tactically, appreciating your teammate's position on the pitch. I never did things like that afterwards. I played the whole professional game in England up until Eddie Howe. I worked with Eddie Howe when I was 33, 34. Finally, here's a manager that works on what you do when you've got a goal kick. That didn't happen. I played the whole time in the Premier League, and I squeezed up the pitch because no one told us why not. But Cesare Prandelli always wanted you to think about what you were doing. There was always a reason behind it.
Of course, this will have English football fans shaking their head and fans of Scottish football as well, I'm sure, given the tactical intelligence that you were taught there. I mean, when you went to Arsenal after Atalanta, would you say you were the most tactically intelligent player there? Not the best player, but the most tactically intelligent, or the only one who'd been schooled that way?
I honestly don't know. I mean, my time at Arsenal was a weird one. I was almost caught in a gap year between the youth team and the first team, and so it was an awkward one. Reserve team football was on its way out, so it was only five or six of us, so it was difficult for me to compare myself against my counterparts of the similar age. What I did notice, and it wasn't necessarily from a tactical point of view, but was talks on diet that we had when we came over to Arsenal, and we were having a dietitian came in, was talking, and it was me and a teammate of mine who'd come over from Italy as well, a guy called Jihad Muntasa, who actually went back to play in Serie A later on and went to Bristol City after Arsenal. And he and I had come through youth teams in Italy, and we're having this meeting on diet, and the questions that the boys were asking about, oh, we're not allowed to do this, we're not allowed to do that, we were looking at each other thinking, like, we've come back in time here 10 years. And Arsenal were very, very, as you can imagine, very forward-thinking, because Arsene Wenger had not long been in. I think 1 year perhaps he'd been in, maybe not even that. So he was implementing all things that he'd experienced, and thought he must have got to Arsenal and thought, oh my goodness, we're miles behind. But for myself and Jihad, who's another person who had similar experiences, we felt that this wasn't novel to us.
So actually, if you'd gone to a less enlightened club than Arsenal, that it might have been a little bit more obvious, wouldn't it? Is the Italian way the way to do it? I mean, they've provided plenty of quality, haven't they? Tacchinardi, I think, was a couple of years ahead of you, and plenty of great players from those Italian academies. But Atalanta is a really renowned one, isn't it? Is that the way to do it, do you think, to make players tactically intelligent, to use the rope?
Oh, goodness. It worked for them. I mean, I used to go back and speak to people and say, where are they now? Where are the players coming through? And everyone would say, it's not like it used to be. The youth teams have gone a different way. They've gone for physicality. They sort of got caught in the middle. And I always thought Italians brought up good technical players and good tacticians. I think when you combine those two things together, you get a typical Italian team. And the fact that they maybe went off course for a little bit for a decade maybe after I'd left there, it's a sad thing really, because you the Italian player was a player with of good school and reliable, and all the stereotypes that then came with, and some of them, you know, are quite annoying, but they actually created a certain type of individual. And if I hadn't had that schooling, I wouldn't have played top level football, because as a point in England, I didn't have anything stand out from a physical point of view, technical point of view. Is it the way? I'm not sure, because in actual fact, whilst it was a very good schooling for me and I wouldn't have made a professional player without it, I didn't actually enjoy it. It was hard. I would leave school at 2 o'clock. I did the British system in an international school in Italy, and I was done for the day from a mental point of view. I wanted to go and play football and kick the ball around in the park with my mates. Anything but. This was even harder than school had been, you know. So if you weren't switched on and focused, then you weren't going to get through training, let alone make the grade by the end of the year. And I appreciate what it did for me, but I couldn't wait to leave it by the end of it, because my brain was probably frazzled.
Do you think without your dad, you'd have packed it in? You wouldn't have carried on doing it?
He was incredible in terms of the support, because I'd actually disliked it so much at times. I really wanted to go back at the start of the next season, but he obviously thought that I had a chance. You know, he forced me is not the right word, but he encouraged me and knew the best way to make me do it. Because by the time you get into the swing of things, September, October, you're good to go again. But when you stopped and you had that little bit of freedom for 2 months when you didn't play, because that's what the break was, it was a bit like, oh my God, I'm like, why do I want to go back in and do that? So because of his passion for football, which definitely rubbed onto me and my brothers, and I had this glimmer of hope to be a player, I was always going to try and see that through to the end.
But you just said something really interesting, which is you as an athlete as a footballer. You must have been really good at football as a kid, far better than anyone that I know, I'm sure. But you as a Bear athlete wouldn't have made it. So what made you make it was what you were taught really in Bergamo. The intelligence is what made you make it, as it were. You didn't have enough special about you to make it without that.
Yeah, I think so. I think they were qualities, not physical, not technical. I wasn't a bad technician. I had a decent left foot, but I'm talking like elite standards. So to play in the Premier League, which in the end I was fortunate enough to do, would I have done that through physical and technical attributes alone? Absolutely not. No, and in fact, the person who gave me my chance in the Premier League, Harry Redknapp, sometimes doesn't get enough credit for his tactical acumen, and most of my games were played against the top teams, where he needed a destroyer or someone in front of the defence who could read situations and try and help keep the score down, which was the case most more often than not. But that's where he used me. He very much saw me as a tactical weapon, and used me then if he had to go and break a team down and win the game playing the really good flowing football that he also managed to get his team to do. So he had an understanding of what I was useful for. So I completely put everything down to my schooling in Italy for my professional career.
And what do you think Prandelli would have made of you as a footballer? You as a, let's say, a 27-year-old Richard Hughes, would he have looked on with pride? I mean, he's a fascinating character, isn't he? He's an extraordinary-looking man, actually, and he's had an extraordinary career. But what would he have sat in front of his television at home and thought of you, do you think?
Do you know, I often think afterwards, when everyone's career goes on and Prandelli's had such a major influence, but would he know who I was? Would he ever have watched the game I played and thought, oh, I used to manage him? He went on to bigger things than I managed to achieve, and he's had so many players come through his school that one year here and there. But perhaps I stood out because I was a foreigner within the Italian game, so it might have been a bit particular. He definitely would have been proud. I definitely think he thought he was onto something by playing me centre back that day. I think if you look at the midfielders that he's had, they're a little bit more creative than me, but he definitely thought I had something that would have made a good centre-back in a Cesare Prandelli team, whether he'd have brought me into his Italy team if I was eligible, of course, and hadn't already played for my actual country. Who knows? But perhaps in some of his club teams, I would have had a slot at left centre-back.
And it was an extraordinary time, wasn't it, as we move towards the end of this, in youth football in Italy at the time. We've already mentioned Pirlo, who you obviously had in your back pocket for 90 minutes. But there were these names, these icons, these rumours and about people, these myths everywhere, weren't there?
There were, and there was something, I don't know what it's like now, of course, but you couple with a really golden age of Italian youth teams with the fact that you've got that mystique without seeing them, hearing about them, reading about them every so often, and then finally seeing them in the flesh and them living up to everything that you'd heard about them. And Alessandro Nesta, when Atalanta played Lazio and in the Primavera Italian Cup that we all went to watch, those ones younger, and he was every bit as good as we knew that this Prince of Rome was going to be. The actual Prince of Rome, Francesco Totti, was he sort of beat us to it. He was in the first team, of course, at such an early age, and he's older. So I missed him from a youth team level. Gianluigi Buffon stepping onto a pitch before another game, Atalanta and Parma, with a mobile phone. And it's like, oh my God, this guy's already got a mobile phone. He had made it. He played in the first team by then. But to think back now and all these players, and it wasn't, you didn't talk about 50 players. You talked about 10, and a lot of them actually were players that played alongside Andrea Pirlo in a World Cup winning Italy team in 2006. So it really was a golden generation of Italian youth team players, and I was fortunate enough to play against a couple.
And just finally, you're a Serie A geek like I am, like a few people listening will be as well, and you talk about it with such love and such knowledge. Do you regret that you never played in it? Because you could have done, couldn't you?
I do regret it, first and foremost, yeah, because that's my football, and you know that's football for me. Serie A is, even though I admired a lot about from a distance, like a lot of Italians did, about the English game and Italian football. Whatever people think about hierarchies, at the time Italian football was ahead of English football, definitely in terms of achievements from the club teams and international team. But there was something nice about the English game, that enjoyment that I look at. It looked so much fun, whereas in Italy it was so hard work, and it was like it was a job, 90 minutes of a job. Do I wish I had sampled it? Yes, but if I propel myself back to when I had decisions to make when I was 17, I would make 100 times out of 100 and make the decision to come back to the UK. But if I, you know, split in parallel universes, I would love to have seen what my career would have been if I'd stayed there. But I think that the thing is, when you're coming through from a Primavera, it's very difficult to make it into the first team. You have to go out on loan. So they've gone out somewhere like Avellino or San Benedettese or somewhere. And do you ever come back from these places? You know, it's difficult. And so lots of, out of the, I don't know how many, 50 teammates that I would have had throughout my journey from under-11s to under-18s, how many of them made it? Only a handful. So I had the possibility to sign professional forms for one of the biggest clubs in England, so it was an easy decision.
And how many more times in your career, from the age of 17 to when you finished, did you play centre-half?
Actually, Mel Machin played me there.
That's the link between Cesare Pandelli and Mel Machin.
Absolutely. Two men that were actually two very good football managers, and Mel in his own right was excellent for me in particular. And he played me. We were against West Bromwich Albion in the FA Cup, and I'd played the whole season at in central midfield. And then the third round of the FA Cup came in January, and we played against West Brom, who were top of the championship at the time, with Lee Hughes scoring two or three goals a game. And Ian Cox, our captain, was suspended, and Mel pulled me to one side on the Thursday or Friday and said, "You're playing left side of centre back." And my partner was Eddie Howe. That time I do remember the score, and we won 1-0 against West Brom. Eddie, as always, takes all the credit because he helped keep the clean sheet and he scored the winning goal. But that was my first experience of playing there at first team level, and I did it twice that season. Both times kept clean sheets, but more to do with my partner, I think, than myself.
Really, finally, as the final mere mortal question, as I like to call them, do you realise how extraordinary us mere mortals find it, that you played for the Atalanta, the Primavera side, against Andrea Pirlo, against other players who'd gone and have a career, Bonazzoni and people like this, and yet you don't remember the score? Because we'd all think we'd have a scrapbook. You understand what I'm saying there? Do you realise how extraordinary we find that? I mean, I think I would feel I'd remember every second of that.
Well, there was me thinking I've done quite well to remember 20 years ago what happened, but it's I'm probably one of the better ones for recalling personal achievements and scores within the game. But then as that's a very significant game, but bear in mind that I didn't realise its significance until later on when Pirlo becomes who he does. And then I was it wasn't the last important game I played, it was actually the beginning of the journey. So if you ask me my last game in football, I'll remember it. If you ask me my debut in proper men's football, I'll remember that as well. That one is only one that I had to sort of, obviously it was significant enough because it was everything I touched on earlier about the feelings of the match day and how important the game it was and the difficulty of the game. But it's not until you sort of recall afterwards and you try and get those memories back that I can remember more and more about it. And probably if Andrea Pirlo hadn't lined up for the opposition, I would have forgotten about it by now.
One day, I'll get hold of Prandelli and ask him if he remembers Richard. It would mean a lot if he did. Richard will carry on working as a spotter of talent and doer of deals, and also an acute analyst of Serie A, which remains, of course, the greatest football league in the world, to some of us anyway. Next week, in our final episode, a story that you won't want to miss, of how a normal person, a decent person, can turn into a maniac for 2 minutes. It's the day I lost my head.
Joey Barton going bonkers, getting sent off. Next thing that flashes up as I'm feeding my little lad his milk, and here are the other people that have gone mental, got sent off. There I am. He didn't know his ass from his elbow then, so I couldn't have gone, "There's your dad there, that's what he used to do, go mental at people." And then there was something in, I was reading the Daily Mail, top 50 notorious Premier League players. I'm in there somewhere as an unremarkable player that went bonkers one day and sealed his place in a list such as that. So you've got to see it with some form of humour, whether it's dark or a little bit lighter, I think.
The Match is produced and presented by me, Dave Farrar, and is a Speechless Media production in association with IMG Media. Thanks to Matt Vines for his editing work, and to Steve Tebb and Ollie Neen for their support. And thanks too to Richard for his time and indeed for his friendship. You can follow us on Twitter at The Match Podcast, and please take the time to rate and review us on iTunes. 5 minutes to you, a world of difference to us.
This time last year, I dreamed that you'd gone. So strange to feel obliged to stop and mourn. dreamed you'd gone. Woke and saw you and cradled your head, thought of a million things and one that I could say to you instead. We passed the time, dear, and I cradled your head. I like to keep things simple, I hate to get too solemn. If I say that people kill for what we got in common, would it be too ungrateful to say it's just not enough for us to remain? Last night.